Hello, I'm Kevin Barrett. Please go to truthjihad.com and subscribe to make sure that there will be radio worth listening to. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth and having a lot of fun in the meantime by meeting great people with all sorts of interesting things to say. And the best part is when I find stuff that I really, really, you know, appreciate in terms of its informational content. I admire the way it's argued, and this is important communication. Wow, I'm really impressed on that level. But also when it's fun to read, that always helps. Maybe that's why I majored in literature, is supposedly that's fun to read, at least more fun than philosophy. Anyway, well, we're going to bring on somebody here who actually is fun to read, as well as extremely thought-provoking, and we have a great new piece out. The piece is called Faith, Reason, Fanaticism, and the Deeper Meaning of the Donald. At least that's a headline at the UNS Review. And the author is Jonathan Revusky. He's the man who coined the term Roger Rabbit narratives for ludicrous cartoon-like depictions of events that couldn't possibly happen that way, sort of like 9/11 and so on. And here we've got a whole new opening on what he calls anti-religious, religious fanaticism. So let's go to it. Welcome, Jonathan Revusky. How you doing?
Oh, good. How are you?
I am well, and even more well when I find a new Jonathan Revusky article. You know, I'm actually looking forward to these long pieces you churn out.
Well, I mean, there's like half a year since the last one. I mean, it's been brutal. You know, it's not that I was working on it full time or anything, but on off, and it was a bear to finish that article. You know, it turned out rather differently from what I thought I was even going to write. So. You know, I really wanted to write something about the so-called four horsemen of the new atheism, Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens and the other two, Dennett and Harris. They call themselves the four horsemen. I guess it's like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They paint themselves in dashing heroic sort of imagery.
Yeah, and it's all kind of media spectacle, too. You know, there's been an intellectual conversation about religion and atheism going on forever. But then we had this media spectacle on 9/11, and now we've got this media spectacle of these so-called four horsemen, where the intellectual content is not really all that impressive.
Yeah, I thought the intellectual content is just horrific, really. I mean, I got my hands on, a PDF of the God Delusion, you know, which is the Dawkins anti-religious screed. And it's just horrendous. I mean, it's really, I think it borders on intellectual fraud. A lot of the arguments he makes, actually, you know, it's really bad.
Yeah. And you're not saying this is a true religious thing. You're saying this as a critical thinker.
Right. I'm actually not saying it as a person who's, you know, a religious person. I just find the arguments that he makes to be, ghastly. I mean, there's a complete confusion on so many levels. He's arguing that. Well, there's the confusion between whether religious doctrines are literally true and whether they're harmful, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's sort of confusing between these various things. I mean, I don't know where to begin on it. There's another one by Hitchens called God Is Not Great. I don't know if you know that one.
Yeah, I think I did read that back in the day when it came out. Or parts of it.
When would that have come out? Maybe about 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think that was one of the earlier ones. I mean, I think it was post 9/11, though. All of this stuff seems like 9/11 was almost the PR launch for this whole project.
Oh, yeah. Well, the anti-religiosity of these people is in practice about 80% Islamophobia. There's no question of that. I mean, one of the things you start wondering about when you look through the Dawkins book is this has sold millions of copies. I mean, you'd think, well, how could something like this sell millions of copies?
Well, I mean, look at the bestseller list, Jonathan. I mean, come on. How many of those are actually really the best things that have been written?
Right, but it's still, I mean, they're what's sold. I mean, yeah, there's something like, you know, the Dan Brown stuff, like the Da Vinci Code, I mean, that was a bestseller.
And that's actually surprisingly good at what it is, you know. Call it fluff, but it's pretty good fluff.
Well, it's fun to read. I mean, it's fun to read. I mean, everybody was reading. I mean, people were actually reading it. I mean, you got on the, you know, if you got on the train, you know, there would be somebody reading that damn book, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know when I've seen people actually reading The God Delusion on public transport. I mean, I don't know. Maybe people I have a strong suspicion that it's sort of somehow promoted, you know, to be a bestseller, because I just wonder why, you know, because if you're not religious to start with, why would you read the book, really? Mm-hmm. You just don't believe, so why do you need somebody to evangelize atheism to you, right? Mm-hmm. You don't,
well,
you're just
well,
not a believer,
always,
right?
There's always a place for reasoned arguments, but that's not what we're getting with these books.
Well, Well, here's an example. Like, I think it's on page one or something, or, you know, of God Is Not Great. Hitchens tells a story, and he tells it in some video as well. He tells this anecdote, which is supposed to show how terrible religion is. Like, I don't know if he's in it personally, but somebody's at a roadblock somewhere in Northern Ireland. And the people at the roadblock, I don't know if soldiers or, you know, Sinn Féin or who, ask the guy in the car, are you a Protestant or a Catholic? And the guy answers, I'm an atheist. And the punchline is that the other guy then says, oh, but are you a Protestant atheist or a Catholic atheist?
Mm-hmm.
And this was supposed to, according to Hitchens, show how terrible religion was and religious fanaticism. And it's like he doesn't even understand his own anecdote, right? I mean, when the person asks him, are you a Protestant atheist or a Catholic atheist? Actually, what it means is it's actually not about religion. It's an ethnic conflict, right?
Of course.
It's a conflict between Anglo-Protestants and Irish Catholics. It's an ethnic conflict. So you know, it's like, who are your people, right, ethnically speaking? So you don't get out of it by saying I'm an atheist, because it's really an ethnic conflict. So you say I'm an atheist. No, but are you an Anglo-Protestant atheist, or are you an Irish Catholic atheist, right? So if you took religious belief out of the picture, these people would still beat each other's throats, right?
And the same thing is exactly true in some of the places in the Middle East right now where there's supposedly religious conflict. For example, there were reports that ISIS, after capturing certain places in Iraq, would sort of line up the young males and then ask them to show how they pray. And if they were to try and do a Salat prayer in the style of Shia, then they kill them. And if they do it in the style of Sunni, they don't. I don't know if that's true or not, but there were these reports.
Yeah, I have no idea what it's true.
But of course, that just shows that it has absolutely nothing to do with religion, that these so-called, you know, religious sects are actually functioning as markers of ethnicity, as you said.
Well, there's a similar one right at the beginning of God Delusion in the, it's the preface, so it's not even page one. It's like the pages still have Roman letters. And Dawkins, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, I thought the line had maybe gone dead. You know, Dawkins is saying, oh, yes, well, look how terrible religion is. You have this conflict in the Middle East and this conflict in Northern Ireland. You know, he uses Northern Ireland again. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm here in Spain, and there's a similar, you know, broadly similar conflict, say, between the Basques and the other, and you know, the Castilian Spaniards. And the Basques and the rest of the Spaniards are all Roman Catholics, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a religious conflict at all. So, and you have that in Ukraine, too. I mean, they're all Eastern Orthodox Christians in principle, pretty much.
Right. And just one thing to mention about Iraq is most of these so-called extremist ISIS types are atheist, secularist, Saddam Hussein holders honors. Those are the people who organized ISIS along with the U.S. and their friends. So they're atheists. Well, basically, ISIS is an atheist group, and, you know, that's where all its military prowess is coming from. It's the Ba'ath
Party.
Well,
I don't even know who the hell these people are, really. I mean, it's confusing. Whoever they are, they're not interested in killing a bunch of homosexuals in a bar in Orlando, Florida, I wouldn't think. But, you know, I mean, there are all these, you know, these strange narratives running through everything.
Well especially when the guy who's accused of killing the homosexuals in the bar is not only a homosexual himself, but he's an habitué of the bar who's been there picking guys up for years.
Yeah, that I heard too, and something similar with the guy who supposedly drove the truck in Nice, the Tunisian, you know, truck driver. I mean, this guy was some kind of complete sex maniac. I mean, he was married, but he was also, you know, had, I mean, I guess like Omar Mateen had all these gay dating apps and, you know, and at all, you know, and he, you know, was totally promiscuous in the gay community, and he'd, you know, been in prison, doubtless, you know, having a gay time there, you know. I mean, he wasn't, but the thing is, he wasn't religious at all, really. It doesn't seem. I mean, they just got all these, you know, but he was the patsy, I guess.
And
I
so
mean,
many so. Of the, so many of these supposed radical Islamic patsies are like that, like the so-called 19 hijackers, the alleged hijackers who actually weren't on the planes, were a bunch of, you know, hard-drinking, prostitute-chasing, lap-dancer-dating, pork-chop-relishing, you know, cocaine-snorting playboys, you know, go flying around in gambling junkets in Vegas on Abramoff's casino boats. You know, the whole narrative that they were radical Muslims is ludicrous on its face just based on massive information from the mainstream media.
Well, they create this whole narrative about, you know, Islam being the problem. It's true. I mean, I had dinner with a friend of mine who's, you know, a Canadian who lives here. And he was in the military. In fact, he served in Afghanistan, though actually before 9/11. It's interesting because he wasn't even officially there, but he was there. I mean, so, you know, I was talking to him about that. But apparently when he got out of the military, they gave him some money, and he went off to France. He told me, yeah, I went, well, the way the conversation developed was, you know, we were listening. I was putting on some, you know, Rai music, you know, Khaled and Cheb Mami and these people, and he knew the music, right? And I said, oh, really? You're into that too? And so yeah, I developed an appreciation for Rai music when I was in France, and you know, I went off and lived in Toulouse for a year. I think it was Toulouse, and I lived, you know, in the poor area among all these, you know, Arabs or, you know, Arab ethnics. I mean, they were born in France, I assume, most of them. But, you know, but then I thought to ask him a question. Yeah, so you hung out with these people. He said, yeah, and we would party and everything. And I said to him, how religious were the Arab ethnics that you knew in France and hung out with? And he said, none at all. You know, not at all. I mean, none of them were at all religious, you know.
And the next stage revealing that secret is finding out that the less religious they are, the more the types of problems that are often blamed on religion are likely to show up. You know, I learned this going to Morocco and then other places. The religious people in the Muslim communities tend to be, for the most part, morally upright and, you know, really people you could trust your life to, people who are never going to cause you any problems. Whereas if you want to find trouble in a place like Morocco, which a lot of Americans do by getting interested in the hashish scene and things like that, you're going to be moving amongst non-religious people and you might very well get into trouble. And likewise, in France, they've had some riots and things like that. That's not coming out of religion. That's coming out of the most non-religious element. And indeed, there are statistics. Jabba Jamil has brought up many of them, showing that the more religious of a Muslim you are, the better off you and everybody around you is on a whole long list of indicators of, you know, good and bad, you know, social behaviors and so on. So the, you know, reality is it's just completely upside down from what they tell us.
Well, you don't need to convince me of any of that. I mean, though I know this is going out to your listeners, but I mean, the social marginalization. No, I mean, if you did the thought experiment that all the Arabs in France were Christian Arabs, I mean, you would probably have pretty much the same problems of social marginalization and everything. But, because it doesn't really have anything to do with Islam, I don't think.
But, well, they try to make it look that way. You know, a classic example is after 9/11, I forget which neocon writer it was, on the 50th anniversary, I believe it was, of the Bobby Kennedy shooting. So wait a second. Could that have been 50th? No, that's not. They haven't had it. It must have been the 40th
anniversary.
Sirhan. He was the first Muslim terrorist.
And then, you know,
somebody pointed out he wasn't even from a Muslim background. He was from a Palestinian Christian background. And this neocon that said, well, but he had caught the virus of the Islamic terrorism. And of course, that's so ridiculous, especially since Sirhan was a hypnotic patsy. He'd been programmed to fire a couple of harmless shots to direct attention towards himself while the real killer pumped the bullet into Bobby's head from point blank range behind him. But once again, we're getting this massive deception, all of it, you know, pointing towards religion and towards Islam as being some kind of problem, which it isn't.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware of that. But in the framing of my article, the thing about this latest article is I didn't talk as much about the whole Islamophobia issue as I had originally intended to, because I realized it was a big topic and I had to leave it for another article. You know, so in a sense, I set up the groundwork to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But, you have this, they're all, yeah, they're, but this framing of what's that thing, Huntington, the clash of civilizations, some kind of.
Yeah, Bernard Lewis actually created that expression and then Huntington ran with it.
Oh, that was Bernard Lewis, yeah.
Well, Huntington wrote the book with that title, but Bernard Lewis invented the phrase Clash of Civilizations.
Yeah, that old guy, he's still alive, or he was a month or two ago.
Isn't that amazing that our world is still being run by, you know, centenarians, these 100-year-old guys. I think Brzezinski and Kissinger are both turning 100 right about now, and Lewis must be up there too. So, you know, I don't know how this works, that these mummies are somehow being preserved to rule the world.
Well, they do have access to good medical care, I guess, but it didn't.
Maybe they should wrap them in sheets and build a pyramid for them and let them just rule from the heart of the pyramid.
Yeah, it's but really, of course, well the one thing I did mention in this latest article is that incredible thing in France, the so-called Burkini controversy. You know, I mean, isn't the idea of giving women fines for not showing enough skin an incredible concept?
It is bizarre, isn't it? You know, I was being the local representative of my Islamic community in a local tavern last week at the Green Bay Packer game, and of course I'm not drinking any alcohol in there. But it's probably pretty haram even to be there. But, you know, I got to cheer for the Packers or I would have nothing in common with my community.
Well, is it haram to drink an orange juice in a bar?
Not in my Islam it isn't. But anyway, so I was in there, cheering for the Packers and stuff.
Yeah, I think God would forgive you for that.
I would think so, too. And somehow this topic came up of the women in France being arrested and fined for not showing enough skin on the beach. And somebody said, I know they're topless over there. Are they arresting them for not going topless? Well, no, I hope not. And somebody else said, well, that'd be a great idea. So this is the way they think here in this liberated women's culture.
My position would be to make the bikini mandatory for the beautiful ones and make the burkini mandatory for the fat, ugly ones. I know.
Why, you vicious, horrible sexist. You almost sound like Donald Trump.
Is this a political correctness free zone here?
Well, you know, we're called Truth Jihad Radio, so you are supposed to be able to say what you think, no matter how offensive it may be. all of this, of course, is illustrating how ludicrous it is to be arresting and fining women for not showing enough skin on the beach. I mean, it is, you know, it's like out of some kind of, you know, surreal comedy or something. But it's real. It's happening all over France.
Well, the thing about it is, I mean, that's like 30 different beach municipalities in France at roughly the same time all decide that this is such a problem that they need to do something about it. You know, I mean, what is the likelihood of that? You know, if 30 different municipalities all deciding at the same time that this is a big problem.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if the directive has come down from above, sort of like the directive after the Nice truck attack, to destroy all of the security footage.
Yeah, well, the funny thing about it, aside from, is just that anybody who came up with this idea doesn't have there's a suppression of their sense of the absurd. I mean, it's so absurd to give women fines for not showing enough skin on the beach. You know, it's
you'd think the cops would just, you know, collapse in laughter. how could you seriously be a police officer with dignity walking up to some woman on the beach and say, "Excuse me, ma'am, you're going to have to show some more skin or I'm going to have to arrest you." I couldn't get halfway through that sentence without falling over on the sand and rolling on my back, laughing and beating on the sand.
Well, my point is that it looks like an orchestrated provocation, right? I mean, you know, suddenly this is a problem, right? I mean, also, you look at it, I mean, based on that friend I told you about who went and hung out with the, you know, ethnic Arabs in France, I mean, very few of them are at all religious, right? So if for the sake of argument, the Muslims or the people, you know, were principal Muslims are 10% of the population, but the vast majority of them are not really religious, then what percentage of the population was wearing a burkini outfit, right? I mean, a minuscule percentage probably, right?
I guess. Well, yeah, I guess even having, you know, one or two women who aren't showing all their skin on the beach must be ruining somebody's good time. No, but seriously, Jonathan, you're right. It's obviously orchestrated, and it's obviously part of some, a conscious effort, I think, to stir up tension with the Muslim community.
Right. It's a strategy of tension because, you know, even if you yourself are not religious, but, you know, that's your sister or your mother or somebody getting harassed on the beach. I mean, you might even personally just prefer to her to wear a normal Western swimwear, right? But, you know, but that's her decision. She does this. And then, you know, it's your, you know, mother or sister getting harassed on the beach. You know, how are you supposed to respond to that? You know, I mean, it's creating a lot of tension, I'm sure. I mean, but it's an orchestrated provocation. I mean, there's something, but I don't know. You look at these things and wonder what the agenda is. I think to some extent, I've thought about this. I don't know. I mean, to some extent, the burkini thing is kind of like, you know, maybe they're sort of testing, you know, how, you know, brain-addled or, you know, people are, that they would accept this, you know?
Well, yeah, that's what I always used to think about some of these security pat-downs and procedures in the airports, too. But, you know, Jonathan, I think there is a pretty obvious strategy here behind this, and let me lay it on you. It seems to me that France has been targeted for this strategy of tension, not only by this burkini thing, but also by way of the false flags, which I wrote and edited about in my books.
Yeah, well, the burkini thing is a minor thing. It's just something.
Well, it's part of this larger thing. Yeah, it's part of a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so why would somebody be staging false flag terror events? You know, why would they massacre a bunch of cartoonists ostensibly because of anti-Islam cartoons, and blame the Muslims for that? Why would they shoot up Paris and, you know, blow up some people in the stadium parking lot the following November? Why would they do the truck attack in Nice? Why is France being targeted so intensely? And I'll tell you why I think it is. I think, number one, it's because France is vulnerable to this, because the French national identity is profoundly anti-religious. The French Catholic traditional identity is anti-Muslim because it was formed in reaction to the Muslim invasions from Spain. And the French secularist identity is extremely fanatical, anti-religious. It came out of the French Revolution. And as you say in your article, they still have this version of secularism, which is very hostile to any form of religion in the public sphere. So France is fertile ground for this, number one. But number two, and perhaps more importantly, this is being done, I would argue, by hardline Zionists, the people around Netanyahu. And the purpose of this is to stir up hatred of whatever groups that this all can be then channeled towards the terrorists, who are the radical Muslims, who are the enemies of endless expansion of greater Israel. And France is full of young, hip, secularist types who totally tend to sympathize with the Palestinians. And if you can cast those Palestinians as evil, radical, crazed, fanatically religious Muslim terrorists, then you can stop the movement in France, in Europe, in the United States, throughout the West, towards standing up for the human rights and equality of Palestinians, standing up for the Palestinian resistance that's fighting for those human rights and equality. You can remove the obstacles to the establishment of Greater Israel, which is supposed to include not only what they've stolen and occupied post-67, that Netanyahu is now in such a hissy fit about having the UN tell him that he shouldn't keep building settlements on, but it's supposed to include everything from the Nile to the Euphrates. So that's really what this whole thing is about. This entire so-called clash of civilizations has been created for this purpose. And in France, France has been targeted because France is the ultra-secularist place where you can easily whip up hatred of religion and you can easily whip up hatred of Muslims and Islam. So in a nutshell, I think that's what's going on.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's along the whole campaign to portray Arabs and Muslims generally as a bunch of lunatics is a very long standing campaign. I mean, I'm just thinking, we're not very, you're a bit older than me, but I mean, as far as I can remember, I mean, any Hollywood movie that you'd ever watch, I mean, the portrayal of Arabs. See,
that's exactly right, because who runs Hollywood?
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, it's impossible to avoid connecting those dots. I mean, as much as people want to try to avoid connecting those dots, but what can one do, you know? I mean, the thing in my article is I don't dwell on it that much, but, you know, I do make a point of saying that this thing that I call ARF, you know, anti-religious, religious fanaticism, which I just mean basically as a catch-all term, meaning this kind of Western secular civic religion, you know, that I broadly call ARF, you know, is the extent to which it's a Judeo-Zionist creation is very, very hard to avoid. The funny thing about that is, though, is that this kind of absolute belligerence towards Islam, you know, isn't always, you know, is still, well, I guess what, I don't know when you could trace it back and see where they really got it going big, but if you were to look at the, you know, if you were to look at the early Bolsheviks, you know, dominated by secular Jews, you know, Trotsky and all the lesser ones, these people hated Christianity, right? I mean, they'd go burn churches and torture priests, you know, for fun.
Pretty much like in the French Revolution a century before.
Right, and whatever Western counterparts they had, if there was one entity that they completely, you know, feared and loathed, it would have been the Roman Catholic Church, I assume, right? I mean, and so a century ago, or you know, 90 years ago, you know, in those days, Islam was barely on their radar. You know.
Well, see, this is another reason why they're going after Islam in France. On top of everything else I said, France has an internal political dynamic of basically La France profonde, which is the deep France of the Catholic tradition, versus this sort of metropole, the cosmopolitan metropolises, where they have become hardcore secularists. So that's the basic internal dynamic in France, that the secularists have been beating the crap out of the traditional Catholics for 200 years now. And the problem is that the traditional Catholics have finally basically disappeared. There really aren't any left. How can you continue the structure of the French, you know, basically what the deep structure of French political life, as Lévi-Strauss might put it, without finding some new religious group to replace the missing Catholics who used to be that, you know, lesser pole of political life? They're gone now. So what are you going to find? Well, there still are some Muslims around. There are more people going to mosque in France than going to church, or so we hear. So there's still a little bit more religion there, even though, as you say, the vast majority of Arab ethnic people in France are not particularly religious. There are enough who are religious that's now more visible than Catholicism. And so now the anti-religious side needs somebody to beat up on, and so they're going after the Muslims.
Yeah, though I don't know if you could – well, I'm right here in Spain, and, you know, I would – you know, as I said in the article, I mean, to say that Spain is a Catholic country is, you know – though I suppose the whole process in France is even somewhat further along, but I mean, but if you were just going to take a sober assessment of the situation and look at the mainstream media and academia and so on, all public discourse, I mean, it's completely in the hands of the secularists, right? I mean, it's not. But on the other hand, I don't think I mean when you say that it's complete that there simply are no Catholics anymore, that would be an exaggeration, though admittedly, if you were going to project forward on any trend line the way things have been going for the last 30-40 years, I mean, you'd maybe it is true that in France what's there is vestigial now, you know.
That's a point that Emmanuel Todd makes in his book Who is Charlie. Emmanuel Todd is a sociology professor in Paris, and he wrote this book Who is Charlie after the Charlie Hebdo events to try to analyze the deep structure of what's going on. And what he found is the Socialist Party, which traditionally was the party, the anti-Catholic party, is now representing the deep French Catholics who are no longer Catholic. That's kind of the deep sociological study of it, which does reveal that there has been this really massive decline of religiosity among Catholics in France.
Yeah, I don't know what the full scale of it is. I mean, I'm sort of interested in looking at it. I've got this friend who I even mentioned in the article who has a lot of connections in the Catholic circle still. You know, that's the funny thing. I mean, you know, he told me, you know, this is an anecdote in the essay, but, you know, I've got this friend in Spain, and And, you know, when he was young, he was involved heavily in the church. And I think he was, you know, part of Opus Dei and these things. And at some point, he just, you know, lost his faith and stopped being, you know, religious. It happens. But he was telling me one day, well, you know, I was talking to my sister, and I expressed, you know, that I just wasn't into, you know, this gay marriage thing. Because, you know, he's still actually kind of, you know, pretty much a social conservative, despite not being religious. And then his sister got infuriated at him and called him a fascist and all this stuff. And he said, you know, I run into the people I knew back when I was, you know, religious, and they just, you know, they just greet me warmly. They're real nice to me, you know. They don't reproach me for that I'm not going to church anymore. You know, I mean, they're just...
They don't burn me with the stake.
You know, I mean, that
there's no Spanish Inquisition.
Most, yeah, well, that was a while ago, you know. I mean, actually, if you just look at the world, I mean, the intolerance is pretty much exclusively coming from the secular side. I mean,
nobody expects the secularist Inquisition. Yeah, no, you're
well, even, you know, but how can? I can't hear you too well.
Yeah, sorry, I'm still here. So yeah, how can that be?
Can you hear me well? Because I'm.
Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear.
I can't hear you.
Huh, okay, well, you're coming through loud and clear. I can hear you fine. Maybe I should just let you talk.
Well, now I'm hearing you a bit better. Well, no, but now I'm hearing you better, actually. Well, I was going to ask, how can somebody like Richard Dawkins look at the history of the last century and think the problem is religion? You know, I mean, just look at, you know, the Russian Revolution or any of it. But even if you look at World War One, I mean, Woodrow Wilson said that we're going off to make the world safe for democracy, right? He didn't say we're going off to war for God and Jesus Christ. He said we're going off for this abstraction called democracy, right? I mean, already all of it is sort of amazing when you look at it. You know, you step back and look at these things, and they're sort of amazing because you have the United States that came into being, you know, supposedly, you know, rebelling against the alleged tyranny of the British, you know, King George, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, exactly, you know, how many years later? I mean, 100-odd years later, there's World War One, and they get involved in this war to save the bacon of the British Empire. And they're saving the bacon of the British Empire, and somehow they're... you know, they're making the world, so they're defending democracy. I mean, somehow the British Empire went from this thing they rebelled against, right, to form this country that would be democratic, you know, to being this entity that they would intervene to save in the name of democracy. I mean, they rebel against them in the name of democracy and then save their asses in both world wars.
And almost all of this violence has nothing to do with religion, of course.
Right, I mean, but not, yeah, I mean, the God that they're waging war in the name of is, in fact, democracy, right? I mean...
Exactly. And so that's kind of what your article is revealing, is that what's replaced religion is the sort of glue holding societies together is now this new, you know, you call it ARF, this kind of anti-religious religious fanaticism, but there's this new sort of secular creed that's now functioning the way religion used to.
Yeah, it has many of the characteristics of a religion, but you know, it isn't that people have to choose between. I mean, it's a very complex panorama. You know, it's you know, a friend of mine visited me last year, who I hadn't seen for a long, long time. And back when I knew him in the university, he, you know, I don't know whether he was very religious or any of it, but it was, never came up, you know. And then I corresponded with him, I mean, over a long period of time. And he was talking to me about the Gospels and all this stuff and telling me about, you know, that somehow he'd become some sort of evangelical Christian. But he visited me in Spain. I mean, he was only here for 2 days. And I remember distinctly that, you know, I started talking to him about these deep political issues, but the very last day, and we were on the train, you know, I was going to, and he, you know, I was, and he was saying these sorts of typical arfy things like, oh, well, you know, John, I'm convinced that the best system to live in is democracy. And I said to him, well, is this system that we live in democratic, do you think? You know, I mean, it was, but anyway, I mean, I was just
that
sort of asking
pretty heretical
questions. Well, he was getting very nervous, you know? I mean, he was getting very nervous. I mean, his body language, I'm thinking back to it. He was getting very nervous when I started asking him these questions about, you know, whether we really lived in democracy. And it occurred to me after that that had I said, you know, I don't think there's a God or there was Jesus or anything, he probably wouldn't have liked it, but I don't think he would have got as antsy.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. So David Ray Griffin's point in his book 9/11 and Nationalist Faith, which is that one of the main reasons that U.S. Americans can't bring themselves to look at the facts about 9/11 is that this kind of nationalist religion has replaced religion and is now an article of faith, and they'll feel like heretics if they question it. And so this is all sort of supporting that point. And then you bring 9/11 into this argument by citing Jeremy Scahill going through this bizarre kind of song and dance as he's confronted with somebody, you know, questioning him about what really happened on 9/11, and he is forced to kind of, you know, just mindlessly recite this catechism of not being a truther,
yeah,
while at the same time mindlessly reciting the catechism of, but we're living in a secular democracy, so yeah, it's okay, you can have any opinion you want, even if it's that crazy and heretical. And basically, he was just tying himself in knots out of his being, you know, governed by this unconscious, unquestioned allegiance to this bizarre sort of anti-religious fanaticism in service to democracy and secularism, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, isn't that Scahill clip kind of excruciating? I mean, I made fun of him, something awful. He's not even that bad a fellow as far as I can tell, you know. I mean, one below in the comments, somebody says, how dare you criticize Jeremy Scahill, all the wonderful investigative journalism he did on Blackwater, and you're not fit to, you know, lick the soles of his feet, or, you know, whatever. I mean, he said that somebody said. Yeah, that's right under the comments of the article on the Unsite. And I just said, well, look, you know, I don't doubt that Scahill has done some good work, you know, and that these other people have done some good work. It's just not about Scahill specifically, because all of these guys will behave that way in that spot, right?
Well, I've seen a number of them. I remember asking Matt Rothschild, who was then the editor of The Progressive, about 9/11 once, and watching him go through a kind of a similar set of, you know, bizarre contortions. And I think there have been others too, but that's one that jumps out.
Well, there's one you can see on YouTube of this guy, Hedges, Chris Hedges.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's there. I think it's I don't know if you've seen that. I think it's this guy, John Gold, comes up to him and starts talking to him about 9/11. He starts mouthing off all this nonsense about Muhammad Atta being such a genius and so forth. But you look at Hedges' body language. I mean, you know, he just looks like he's about to just bolt, you know, to run away, you know, but he just
and then
can't
how about
bring
Chomsky?
Himself to.
I mean, talk about, you know, turning, you know, tying yourself into knots when faced with 9/11. I don't think anybody's done that more than Chomsky.
Oh, yeah, Well, I don't know what's worse, Chomsky himself, or like when you watch him on that clip where he's at the University of Florida and all of these idiots are cheering everything he says. You know, I mean, that's just But of course, the issue is that if he were really what he represents that he is, I mean, would he be promoted so much, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings up a kind of a contradiction at the heart of this anti-religion religion that now dominates the West. And that is that on the one hand, they're required to have total faith in these articles of fact as reported by all of our mainstream institutions, which are so wonderful. You know, they're pretty much like, they're like the Pope. I mean, it's you know, now it's not the Pope who's infallible. Now it's our mainstream institutions that are infallible. So you have to have absolute faith in them and everything they say, no matter how ludicrous it may be. And then at the same time, you're supposed to support free inquiry and open critical thinking and so on and so forth. And those two things obviously come into conflict all the time, nowhere more blatantly than with the case of 9/11.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing about the kinds of arguments that Dawkins... Well, I've got the electronic edition of both the Dawkins book and the Hitchens book. I read more. I haven't read either one straight through because I just don't have the stomach for it. I read, you know, the first 100 pages of the Dawkins book sequentially and then just started jumping around to see what he said about different issues. You know, what I did, though, is a search, and the word, you know, like from psychology, compartmentalize or compartmentalization, I was looking for that word in both in both books, and it doesn't appear a single time. You see what I'm getting at? Compartmentalization? I mean, their idea is, their basic argument is, well, you know, these religious people believe some crazy thing, and therefore they're crazy. I mean, in reality, the truth of the matter is much more complex than that, you see. The religious person will proclaim his belief in something that is kind of prima facie a bit crazy, but they believe it in a sort of mythical time space, right? Mm-hmm. So the religious person will say, oh yeah, Moses shook his stick and the Red Sea parted, right? But if you tell that same person that, you know, Fred went down to the waterfront and shook a stick and the sea parted, they're not going to believe it any more than a non-religious person, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you tell a fundamentalist Christian that Jesus walked on the water back when, and they can say, oh, yes, Jesus walked on the water. But if you tell them that the other day Kevin Barrett was walking on the waters of Lake Michigan, they're going to decline to believe you, right? I mean, you tell them that the visibly pregnant girl next door is a virgin, and they're not going to believe it any more than anybody else is going to believe it. You know, the compartmentalization of the whole thing is because finally that you believe that some supernatural event, some miracle happened, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago in biblical times is one thing, but to believe that a miracle happened in Lower Manhattan on 9/11/2001, the practical implications of the latter strike me,
Oh, come on, Jonathan. Didn't you know that
all
the laws of physics
in the Red Sea parted first?
The laws of physics were all suspended on September 11, 2001. How can you reject this article of faith?
Yeah, though they don't admit it, they just, you know, they invent it as they go along. But in essence, that's what they're saying. I mean, it's very hard. You know, they can't get around it. I mean, to believe that Jesus walked on the water 2,000 years ago. It doesn't really, you know, as a practical question in the here and now, it doesn't really matter too much, you know. I mean, whereas if somebody was willing to believe that Kevin Barrett was walking on the water, you know, the other day, I mean, this is a much more serious matter, right?
Well, even my most avid listeners don't seem to believe that.
You hear me?
Yes, yes. I haven't had anybody tell me that they've seen me walking on water.
Huh?
Yeah, I haven't heard anyone witnessing any such miracles with regards to myself, but...
But my point is that the Dawkins sort of claim that religious people don't believe in science is actually rather overblown. I mean, it's kind of compartmentalized. They'll believe a sacred narrative in which something supernatural happens, but actually in the here and now, the religious person believes that the laws of science apply just as much as everybody else does. David Ray Griffin, I don't know what his take on the Bible stories is, but David Ray Griffin does not believe that the laws of physics were suspended on 9/11.
Well, that's right. He's actually very empirical in his approach to all sorts of areas, including areas that bear on whether or not there may be some of these bizarre phenomena that are reported as miracles, levitation and so on. There is, in fact, a tremendous amount of evidence that occasionally things like levitation and the various kinds of psi abilities have happened. And, in fact, psi abilities are attested to as a kind of a regular and predictable kind of activity that you can prove scientifically pretty much any time you want, ever since the Rhine experiments of the 1950s. And Griffin is on top of all that stuff, too. I mean, he's far more empirical in his orientation than virtually all of the hardcore science types like Dawkins.
Yeah, but to the extent that... To the extent that the religious people believe in miracles, by and large, it's in a sacred time-space that is in a separate sort of mental compartment. I mean, they don't believe, that miracles are going on in the here and now world in which they live. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's and a key. I don't know how you would describe this except with the word, compartmentalization would be the word in psychology, right? There's this guy, Stephen Jones, the physicist. I was reading some, people trashing, somebody was trashing him. Not to be confused with Alex Jones, who's a completely different person. But Stephen Jones, the guy's a Mormon, from Utah. And he's serious about it. So people were saying, well, Stephen Jones believes that Jesus came to Salt Lake City, Utah, and left some scrolls, or I don't know what he did, And I mean, I don't know. I guess Stephen Jones believes this or says he believes it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, to me, I mean, that's an incredible thing to believe, Kevin. I mean, how did Jesus get to Salt Lake City, Utah? I mean, did he fly the friendly skies or what?
It's actually worse than that.
You can walk on water. It's a long walk, isn't it?
But, I don't know if it was Jesus in Salt Lake City or if it was the Book of Moroni coming down to Joseph Smith. But in any case, it is a pretty amazing claim. And yes, Steve Jones does believe that as far as I can tell. I've spent some time with him. He was actually showing me some stuff in the Book of Mormon that he thought was relevant to this era that we're living in of conspiracies. But that has nothing to do with his physics judgment.
I'm not here to laugh at people's religious beliefs by any means. Point is, it seems to be in a completely separate mental compartment. It doesn't, his belief that Jesus was in Salt Lake City, Utah, is in a separate mental compartment and does not interfere with his ability to do scientific research, right?
Yeah, in the piece, you say that Trump was elected by people reacting against the sort of political correctness of this ARF, anti-religious religious fanaticism.
Yeah, I feel that. They're being told that, you're terrible. It's almost being represented to them that supporting Trump is an act of heresy, right? It would seem that the people behind the Hillary Clinton campaign overestimated the appeal of this sort of secular, what I call ARF framing, that they just figured that if they could say that Trump was, a sexist and a racist and a whateverist, that they just have clear sailing, right? they thought that they could frame the question a certain way. And these, you know, Brexit was a close vote too, I guess.
So let's go ahead and finish up. We only have a minute or two left by going over these sort of four main doctrines of the anti-religion religious fanatics that everybody is supposed to believe in.
Yeah, I classified them as, you know, DM, the democracy myth, and the second strand is PC, and the third as CT, which I could alternatively call the New York Times cult, that if something's in the New York Times or the mainstream media, it's just true. And then the fourth, which is a biggie, is the good war, you know, the extreme good, evil, Manichaean interpretation of the Second World War, and practically, you know, lending religious significance to it. I mean, so I, and of course, the whole Holocaust issue is, yeah, that's a big issue, really, the extent to which they've constructed a sacred narrative around it. It seems that, you know, one can get away with being a heretic on one of the things. I'm so, you know, I mean, you can get away with being anti-PC up to a certain point, I think. Mm-hmm. The one interesting thing is that these Ukrainian nationalists that they supported in this coup in 2014, you know, I mean, those people don't believe in the GW, in the good war myth. I mean, they have a completely different take on World War II, and clearly for them, the Soviet Union and Stalin was utterly evil because, of course, their ideological forefathers fought on the side of Hitler, right? Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing.
And our neocons are supporting those people, interestingly enough.
Right. I mean, you read the Saker, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Saker doesn't miss an opportunity to call these, you know, the Ukrainian junta Nazis, right? Mm-hmm. I actually have a different take on that, by the way. I don't agree with the Saker on that. I mean, I think that, you know, one understands what he's doing. He's sort of taking the good war narrative and apply, you know, I think you're falling into their framings when you start calling people in the year 2016 or in 2017, you know, Nazis and fascists, you know. It's because actually it's completely understandable that the Ukrainian nationalists fought on the side of Hitler, right?
Right.
I mean.
Yeah. This is the same thing I was talking about recently with an associate of David Ray Griffin, who was, say, you know, defending David Ray Griffin's claim that global warming, another GW for you, is the moral equivalent of Nazism, and we have to mobilize on a World War II footing to defeat global warming. And I said, that's the wrong approach. You know, it buys into this World War II myth that you're talking about.
Yeah, but it also doesn't make a damn bit of sense, does it? Because how does rising CO2 levels is goose-stepping Nazis? I mean, how do you get from one to the other?
Well, of course, what they really mean is they're calling for mobilizing society in such a way that virtually all of our productive capacity.
I understand.
Yeah. Everybody drop everything they're doing and go to work in Rosie the Riveter's shop building anti-CO2 machines or, you know, whatever.
And you're right. The problem is that the Germans and the Japanese of that time period weren't actual, you know, enemy nations, whereas global warming is a, well, you understand my point. I mean, it's like comparing, you know, I don't know what to, but I guess there is this idea that's the most powerful myth we have in society. Mm-hmm. So if you can leverage that myth, right, even though it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. And so those of us who question all of these myths are in trouble. Like you said, you can get away with questioning one, but those of us who question all of them tend to take a lot of flack.
Right. You can get away with questioning certain things. You know, their core beliefs that you might be able to question. Like I said, you know, you could maybe get away with saying Winston Churchill was a rat bastard, but you can't. Though you probably make some people uncomfortable, but you'd never get away with saying, I mean, just to say that Churchill wasn't nearly as great a guy as is claimed, you could get away with. But to say that, you know, Hitler wasn't nearly as evil as what they're claiming, you can't get away with. That's core heresy, right?
Well, you can get away with it here on Truth Jihad Radio, and I think we've just surpassed the end of the hour. But I invite all of my listeners to stand with you, Jonathan Rivusky, and say, my German pronunciation here is probably bad, Ich bin ein Heretiker. I am a heretic. So thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate your great work.
Yeah, heretic.
Keep it up.